It's a truism, of course, that we live in revolutionary times. It's a simple observation. There are many, especially among the young, who wonder about the style of our national life, who bitterly criticize many of our institutions and customs, who seem to ache to perform some rather radical surgery upon our structures and our institutions. The criticisms tend to be scathing, sweeping, and condemnatory. They see little that is sanguine or happy. They look on our nation as racist, as violent, as trapped by economic privilege, and as both banal and hypocritic. They despair of the traditional policies and programs of change, debate, committee, reason, and the ballot box. They hold that we are so enmeshed in the present system, that we lack the strength of purpose, the constancy of will, the drama of vision to turn our nation inside out and to achieve the radical reformulation of our national life which they seek. As an example, they cite to us the Southeast Asian War, for which the nation never voted, and from which the nation, despite what seems to be overwhelming popular opinion, cannot extricate itself. Their strategy, their tactics, are those of confrontation, of challenge, of exposure. They hope to paralyze some of our institutions, until all of us admit that what we have does not work. We begin to demolish and to tear down our structures so that on the bare ground and from it we can build up new and other, and therefore, to their way of looking at it, better institutions. Now, many of us would take exception to elements in this challenge, in this criticism. Perhaps most of us would deny the validity of the radical strategy which they espouse. But how many of us could or would argue that our nation has taken itself in hand, that it is on top of the problems which surround it, that it is dealing effectively and progressively in a forward-looking way with the problems of pollution and of population, of poverty and of welfare, of war and of international violence? All of us seem trapped by the crescendo of violence rising from the battlefields of the world. All of us are ensnared in the sprawl and the ugliness of our cities. We necessarily nest in their filth. All of us are poisoned by the hate which exists between races and within the society, so much so that every human relationship is distorted and the normal operations of the democratic process become perverted, difficult. And all of us know that our welfare system creaks along, providing inadequate benefits and providing these begrudgingly, that our educational system is anachronistic. There are tens of thousands of young people for whom it does not provide rudimentary literacy, that even this economic system, which has so many productive triumphs to its credit, even this system cannot provide certain security for the willing worker and for the loyal employee. draft, the casualty lists, the headlines, Huff, Watts, all these pour oil on the fire. All these are grist for the mill of those who demand radical solutions. All these are issues which we must confront and which our nation seems unwilling to confront. For I am afraid that when historians write the history of the last several decades, they will say that this great nation was tired out by the Depression and by the war, and it went into a long binge of indolence, indifference, careless living, and it found it very difficult when the time came to shake off the lethargy, to get down to the real business of being concerned with the common weal. Now, whether or not we share the criticisms and the strategy of the radical left, we certainly can be grateful to them for this, that their confrontation, the shrill of their voices, their grab for the headlines and the headlines that they have written and made, have forced all of us to cease to play the ostrich, have forced all of us to admit that the time is later than we seek, that the time is now. Give of ourselves collectively as a nation to the problems which are all about us. Now, many of these young radicals are students, but unfortunately few are students of Scripture. And this itself is a damning fact. I often wonder how it is that so many of the churches and so many of the synagogues of the nation have managed to take this biblical tradition, which we say we espouse and which we teach, and tear out its guts, destroy the basic strength and thrust of its teaching. For where does social actionism begin? But in the classic lives and the classic speeches of the prophets, who attacked those who were at ease in Zion, who condemned those who arrogated power and abused power and were contemptuous of the rights of the ordinary, average human being. It is the classics, it is the prophets who provide to man the classic example of those who will stand up to authority and insist on righteousness and justice, and condemn a nation which has narrow political ambitions and forgets the ultimate responsibility of every nation to seek peace without and justice within. How is it that we have taught generations of people to look upon the Bible as an anthology of innocent platitudes, pious sentimentalities, somehow irrelevant to the real problems of the day? And yet, if the young people knew their Bible, they would recognize that they might take the motto, the mandate of their movement from the very biblical text. See, I have set thee this day, God once mandated Jeremiah. See, I have set thee this day over the nations and over the kingdoms to uproot and to pull down, to overthrow and to destroy, to build and to plant. And without too much difficulty, this Rosh Hashanah celebration of ours might be an annual moment of reconsecration for many of these radical young people. But what is the call of the shofar which we heard sounded this night? But the ancient call which summoned our ancestors to leave their fields, to put aside their daily responsibilities, the ordinary routines of ordinary lives, to come together, to assemble, to discuss some issue of common concern, to assemble, to meet together some common enemy. The shofar is the trumpet call, the call to action, to awaken from the slumber of one's own narrow interests and concerns, to join with all those of goodwill, all one's neighbors in the common weal. And what is the biblical section which is chosen for reading on this Rosh Hashanah? But that classic story of God's command to Abraham to take his son, to take his only son, Isaac, and to offer him up as a sacrifice a proof of his loyalty to God. And what is this story but the ultimate paradigm of the sacrifice each and every man must be prepared to make for those ideals which he normally phrases so easily. We talk of justice. We talk of peace. We talk of freedom. We talk of equal opportunity. But how much are we really prepared to give to achieve these goals and ambitions? What are we prepared to sacrifice? A lunchtime? A committee meeting hour? How much of ourself? How much of our wealth? How much of our power? How much of our social position? How much of the preconceived plan which we have set for our lives? The Bible indicates by this story that we must be prepared, if we mean what we say, to sacrifice that which is life itself and perhaps that which is more precious than life itself. How many of us are prepared to do it? But surely this is the command of Rosh Hashanah. And what is the classic folk tale which surrounds us this night? It's the image of a celestial courtroom. God is the judge. Each of us is the prisoner in the dock. And there is a prosecuting attorney who reads out the sad, rather banal lists of our failures, of our errors, of our weaknesses, of our sins of omission and commission this past year. And there is a defense attorney who enters pleas and mitigation. What we have done that was worthy of us, our acts of kindness, of sympathy, of tolerance, of understanding, of the achievements which have been ours. And then God and we make a tally. And we see in awful perspective how much we have rationalized, how much we have compromised, how much we have justified that was ignoble and unworthy of us. How many times we turned aside from the right way and walked simply the more convenient way. And again, this sense of judging oneself by a standard higher than the ordinary, than the humdrum. This too is part of the teaching, the heart of the revolutionary movement. And finally, Rosh Hashanah shares with the revolutionary movements of the day a doctrine of man, a hopeful doctrine of man. For we bathe tonight in some degree of shame for our past weaknesses, not in order to protest, I could not, my life is predestined, I could not do other than which I did, but in order to say, here I am, this is what I could have been, tonight I resolve to climb the ladder to my better self, to start on the way of life which will lead to a better and more blessed existence. Rosh Hashanah insists on man's capacity to transcend himself, on man's ability to rise above the human beast, above instinctual living, above cunning and animal shrewdness, and to become like unto the angels. And the revolution, too, talks of man's capacity to use his reason, to use his will, to use his courage, to so reorganize society that it will be the society he desires it to be and not a society which is inadequate, unable to provide decency and opportunity for all. Those of us who read tonight, as we did read the prayer, grant us, O Lord, the ability to worship thee with singleness of heart. Must surely understand that the burden of urgency, the message of commitment, the challenge for a radical reorganization of our social and private lives is at the very base of everything that this holy day, these exercises, are concerned with. And anyone who will leave these ceremonies as complacently as he entered must understand that the biblical vision, biblical idiom applies to him, to her. He has eyes, but he sees not. He has ears, but he hears not. And yet, when all this has been said, and the identity of concern, the shared sense of urgency noted, it's patently obvious that this Rosh Hashanah service is far different in almost every respect from a convocation of the New Left, or from a meeting of the SDS. And these differences are not simply differences of style, of dress, of hair, of language, of the beat of the music. Rather, they are fundamental, and they touch issues of attitude and approach and philosophy. And these differences suggest to me that there are at least two radically different approaches to the renewal, the restructuring, the reordering of society, and that Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish tradition, does not necessarily consecrate the road of radical ideology. What are these differences? One certainly is suggested by the burden of what is done here and done in such a meeting. At their meetings, tactics are decided upon and a manifesto is written. Here the tradition is reviewed and the Torah is read. I wonder if you have been struck, as I have been struck these past months and years, by the impatience of the radical movement with the past, its anger with the past. Instead of looking on the past as prologue, instead of being interested in mining the past for the what we might call the inherited wisdom of the race, the theoreticians of the left turn it off, to use their own phrase. They find it a burden, a heavy weight. They feel that it is puts upon man a set of blinders which precludes his seeing the furthest reaches of his horizon. They look upon it as a study in counter-revolution, as holding man back. We live, they say, in a brave new world, which if it did not begin today, began yesterday. Our technology, our science, has liberated us from all that is medieval and archaic and ancient. We need not look back. Let's look ahead. Let's create the future with the building blocks presented to us here and now. Let's not worry about all the experience of men over all the long centuries. And why do they turn back from the past? Because wherever we turn in the ancient philosophies, wherever we read history, wherever we touch a religious tradition, we find a humility, a patience, a concern with values besides the barricade, which they find unacceptable within their philosophic structure. The past is prologue. All that we do here is of the past. The shofar has been sounded with the same calls for the last 3,000 years in the temples and synagogues of Israel. The same prayers, the same music have been long familiar with our people. The mood here is reflective, introspective, one of stock-taking. This is the mood of historical wisdom. If they are ashamed of the past or afraid of the past, it is because the past does not teach the lesson which they feel needs to be taught. The past insists on a truth with which many, so many, are impatient, and it's simply this: that the ultimate restructuring, renewal of society will come about only when man has renewed, restructured himself. The revolution cannot be made simply by attacking someone out there, the establishment, the military-industrial complex, the college administration. The real enemy is right in here, in my own intransigence, in my own folly, in my own impatience, in my own moments of arrogance or cunning or shrewdness, in my own failings, in my own foibles, and in my own weaknesses. Men have made revolutions, many revolutions. And some of these revolutions have been successful. And often a successful revolution has led to a reign of terror, to repression beyond any which existed in the Ancien Régime. Often those who made the revolution were not of the quality of men who could organize freedom, who could restrain their greed, their love of power, once power came into their hands. The classic example of this is the French Revolution. It fought against oligarchy, against the tyranny of the empire, The barricades were thrown up and the barricades deposed the king and the king was guillotined. And there was a rudimentary parliamentary democracy. But the democracy was subverted by its own ambition, by its own intolerance of other opinions, and fell into a reign of terror. And society was so convulsed that some began to cry out, security at any price. And the price was Napoleon. And we need not look to the past to find these examples of successful revolutions, of governments which have overthrown privilege, overthrown injustice, only to foist another kind of privilege or another kind of injustice upon their people. There's Nasser's Egypt. There's Mao's China. There's Kosygin's Russia. There are 100 military juntas in the small nations of Latin America and Black and Arab Africa, which exist because the rudimentary democracy which was created at the beginning lacked the human power to sustain itself and fell before some military junta or some into the hands of some demagogue or powerful individual. Revolutions come and go. The real revolution must take place in your heart and in mine. If we can renew ourselves, if we can become finer and better human beings than we are now, if we can become people who do not need restraints in order to be good, if we can become parents who raise children in the way that they should go, if we become husbands and wives who treat each other with sensitivity and with sympathy so that we leave the house and bring happiness and love and understanding wherever we go, then it's not a question of law and order or a question of justice. It's not a question of this social reform or that social reform. We will have some security. We will have the ability to cooperate easily, effectively, for the common good. Now, I recognize in what I'm saying a danger. There are those who will leave this hall feeling that I have berated the young and the revolutionary, and I've somehow not talked about them. Very few of us here tonight belong to the New Left. But all of us share all of the human weaknesses which are theirs. We are cunning. We are shrewd. We are sometimes contemptuous of others. We are often lazy and indolent. We are often careless of another's need. We are often unsympathetic when sympathy is needed. We often trample on others' feelings. I'm speaking to us and of us, but I'm also speaking to them and of them, because they wear deliberately and self-consciously the prophet's mantle. They far more than we arrogate to themselves the right to criticize broadly any and all activity, any and all agency or institution. And what I fear is this, that in their youthful ardor, in their zeal to make the revolution, they will somehow, by their failures to live the kinds of lives that revolutionaries and prophets ought to live, they will somehow besmirch that social reform which is far more urgently needed, an economic sacrifice which is far more urgently demanded than most of us would care to admit, and that we will find in their human failings an excuse, a rationalization, not to reform the structures of our economic and political institutions. But what troubles me is this. I hear the words. Many of them sound proper, good. But I look at the lives, and I see lives which are careless, and I hear words which are contemptuous of parents and adults, and I hear criticism which is excessive, and I hear a certain arrogance of person which is demeaning to them and to one who must listen, and I see a lack of discipline, of self, of appetite, of feeling. I see love reduced to lust. I see experience exalted above reason. I often hear words which make me wonder if they are truly believers in the democratic process. We need a political and economic renewal. We need all of us, liberal and conservative, right and left, personal renewal. Rosh Hashanah insists on this truth. The first order of business for all men of goodwill is the reordering of their private lives. That your responsibility and mine begins not in the ballot box, though it is there, begins not in the barricade, though it may be there, but begins in the quiet of our homes, in the quality of our relationships with our parents, with our children, with our husbands, with our wives, with our friends, with our neighbors. And who is there here tonight who can justify his life by his liberal activities, by his civic duties, if he knows deep within he has somehow failed his marriage vows or abandoned his children without his attention or been careless to the needs of his aging parents? First responsibility of man is to be a man before he becomes a leader of men. The first responsibility of those who would share in the job of renewing our society is to renew themselves. Take away from this holy moment on this holy day a new determination to somehow improve the whole texture of their lives. The rabbis said what I'm saying to you long ago, and they said it far more simply. Kadesh atzmacha, v'achar kach kadesh acherim. First, sanctify thyself, and only afterwards, seek to sanctify others. That's the burden of this Rosh Hashanah. There are many ways that we must go. There are many political issues which we must confront. Great public sacrifices will be demanded of those of us who operate in the public sphere. Understanding will be necessary of all of us. First and foremost of all of us, we must somehow use the traditions, the understanding, the inspiration of our tradition, and our own qualities of heart and soul and mind, turn ourselves to more qualified human beings, people who are more sensitive and careful and disciplined, more conscious of their own dignity, of the needs of others, more careful of the private things in their lives. The truth I seek to place before you is simply this. If you succeed in raising a son or a daughter who has been loved so that he or she can express love, who has been taught to be sensitive and humane and understanding, that person grown into adult will bring happiness and blessing wherever he or she may go. And you will have wrought a revolution in our world. But if you are careless of the responsibilities of family, confused yourself as to values, if you look upon yourself as someone who must be catered to and served, rather as one who has duties and responsibilities to 100 others, if you mistake your privileges for your duties, then you will walk surrounded by a great cloud. You will destroy the feeling, the hopes, the laughter, the capacities of others. You bring and send misery out into our world. Which is the way that a man should go? It is the old way, Rosh Hashanah's way, the way of righteousness and justice, the way which begins in the home, family, and one's personal self-discipline. and then transcends these to concern for mankind and the great social issues of the day. Kadesh atzmacha, v'achar kach kadesh acherim. First sanctify thyself, and then seek to sanctify others. Amen.